You, Janet. We welcome you, Janet. As just one of our favorite people who has been given yourself so generously to us over so many years. And here you are again in our anniversary series. I'm going to introduce your bio. The Reverend Janet M. Cooper Nelson. Janet is chaplain of the university, director of the Office of Chaplains and Religious Life, and faculty member at Brown University, appointed in 1990 after appointments at Vassar College, Mount Holyoke College, and the Church of Christ at Dartmouth College. As Brown's chaplain, she leads a full multi-faith team of associate chaplains and oversees the university's broad circle of religious life affiliates who advise students' religious organizations. Together, they endeavor to ensure that a diversity of belief has voice and vitality, and that Brown is able to nourish religious literacy and maintain an inclusive climate for its diversity of religious, spiritual, and secular convictions. So we welcome you, Janet, to Women Explore today. And thank you for being here.
Every time I am here, I think to myself, I should be here all the time that you're together because I just gained so much. Thank you so much for that beautiful opening meditation. A former rabbinic colleague of mine would, from time to time, when a meeting had a bright spot in it, suggest that that was maybe Shekinah, that somehow through this morass of stuff we were working on, literally a holy light had shone on some part of it to say, do this instead of all that. So as you were talking, I thought, I'm afraid my experience is such a nuts and bolts one. It's not very elevating, but it brought my colleague back to my thoughts and my mind. And I'm really grateful for that. She's moved on to be the rabbi at Cain Avenue Synagogue in Brooklyn, and is loving her work. So we miss her at Brown, but she's wonderful. And thank you for bringing her back into my mind. It's been a crazy week. I'm probably not surprised to hear that the last time we were talking together, I was talking about the garden. I'm going to be doing it again, so I hope you'll bear with me. It is a place where so much of what, not just what I need, but it's where I find I learn is present. So I want to begin today by sharing a bit of a poem that lately I can't get enough of. It's from a collection that I hope you can see the cover of. It's just the best ever, right? These wonderful puppies who are ready. And in fact, there is a line in this poem about what they're ready to do for you, which is bite every sorrow. But the poem is by Barbara Ross, and it's entitled, You Can't Have It All. You can't have it all, but you can have the fig tree and its fat leaves like clown hands gloved with green. You can have the touch of a single 11-year-old finger on your cheek, waking you at 1 a.m. to say that the hamster is back. You can have the purr of the cat and the soulful look of the black dog, the look that says, if I could, I would bite every sorrow until it fled. I'm excerpting here, so you'll enjoy the whole when you have a chance. She goes on to write, you cannot bring back the dead, but you can have the words forgive and forget, hold hands as if they meant to spend a lifetime together, and you can be grateful. And when adulthood fails you, you can still summon the memory of the black swan on the pond of your childhood, the rye bread with peanut butter and bananas your grandmother gave you while the rest of the family slept. There is the voice you can still summon at will, like your mother's. It will always whisper, you can have it all, but there is this. It's an association I have with this wonderful group that is now called Women Explore, that used to be the TOP program that I first heard about at church at Wellesley College when Elizabeth and David Dodson Gray were part of a group of about 35 of us that gathered to try and help the chaplain at Wellesley not feel like his work had no listeners. It had many listeners, but they were always diffused across a big, wide campus, and he frequently thought no one prayed. But I couldn't read you that poem today without bringing you my latest experiment in horticulture. I hope you can see it. This is a fig tree, the very one that she says has fat leaves like clown hands gloved in green. And if you're a grower, you might know that mostly fig trees in the Northeast need some special attention. I have to say, I find it hard to trust these directions, but you take your fig tree from its sunny place in your garden when the temperature gets to be about 60 or 50. I took it when it was about 48. And I ran with it to the basement. And then I put a note on the wall that said, okay, remember, you put the fig tree in the basement on the 15th of October. And I really didn't know answers to simple questions like, do you water it? Because the reason it was in my basement, according to the custodian in my building, who grows figs like crazy and brings them to me, he knows I love them, is because it has to go dormant. I've listened to my mom, a gardener, talk about dormancy, I think my whole life. In my brain, I think I thought it was a plant hibernating, like a bear, going somewhere dark and cold and, you know, sleeping. But I don't know the answer to this question. I know that when animals come out of hibernation, especially skunks, their stench is really, really potent because they haven't been drinking. And so that aroma is really intense. I think you can see where I'm headed with this. We have stages like plants, like animals, of dormancy. I think sometimes they're brought about by frightening things that happen to us. I think some that I know who have suffered pretty tough emotional and physical illness talk about those times as dormant times when all focus has to really go in the direction of whatever's happening or not happening. And the question of should we be watered during that time? Should we just be put in a place where the temperature doesn't go too low and ignored for whatever is the right period of time? To my custodial colleague at work, he listens to my questions with patience, but his face tells me she doesn't get it. So I asked him again, what do you do with yours? And he said, oh, he said, they're all in great big pots. I've been trying to put them in lighter ones. I just put them in the garage. Well, my garage is really cold. My basement's a bit warmer, but he had no directions about any of these subtleties. When I asked him, I said, is it too cold in the garage? Up on blocks, on the floor, by the window? He said, my garage doesn't have a window. And I said, but it's okay. And all I could see as I asked my questions to his baffled face were these different ways of knowing. He's been growing figs forever. He doesn't distrust his ability to do it. He knows how to do it. His place with figs and the growing of them is not dormant, and mine isn't either. Mine is anxious. Mine is worried. Mine is probably over-worried. When friends come to the house and say, how do you get those orchids to bloom, Janet? I say the things my mother said to me, I ignore them. I put them out under the tree in the summer. I bring them back in again. And sometime after the first of the year, if you look, they're probably getting ready to bloom. Well, do you water them? Do you put an ice cube each week? Is that what you... I have no idea. I go past them from time to time and I kind of put water on them. exactly the way my colleague at work grows figs. I overworry my figs because they're unfamiliar, because I want an outcome. He can prove he knows what he's doing, right? He puts the figs on my desk. They're yummy. He has 4 and 5 different varieties. I've got this one kind of spindly, but I'm pretty proud of it, tree that's leafing out again. It's bigger than it was 2 years ago, but I've been at this for 2 years and I'm still asking. My point is to say, a bit with Barbara Ross, there may be things that no matter how much we ask, how much we learn, how much we hope to be kind of a natural at it, it's just going to be awkward. And we're going to sit at the feet of those who are good and able to do these things and ask our questions, and they will patiently answer, often in the way that in the places where we know things deeply, we sort of tip our head and think, I don't know, I ignore my orchids. But if for you they're new, you don't know them, they're not your sisters, and they don't live on your counter. Mine were my mother's. They're old, and they don't bloom all the time. I have no idea what the periodicity is of their blooming. They just bloom from time to time. I know what color they are. I know every time they bloom, they just absolutely amaze me, and I take their picture over and over and over again, like they were my grandchildren. I send them to you, or to your mom, or anybody else that I think might be fascinated to see an orchid blooming in February. I notice that they're purple as Lent is beginning, and I think somehow their color is intentional. Is that Shekinah, maybe? But the fig in the basement, it worries me. I'm pretty sure I don't have it right. I think I should have done this or that. I put signs on the wall to tell me what time in the month it is that I should rewater it, and find out from my colleague at work, he doesn't water them. What a shock. Puts them in the garage, leaves them there where I think it's much too cold. But remember, he gets figs. I've yet to have that experience, and I'm hoping for it. But I think even if I have a fig come, I think I'm still going to worry about these figs. I don't think they are ever going to feel anything other to me than miraculous. And that's what I'm hoping for. And in this business of nourishing our spirits, particularly in the context of an ecology of nourishment, an ecology, as Barbara puts it in this poem, where we know we can't have it all, where we can't bring back the dead, and where we dearly wish that dog that lived with us could bite every sorrow till it fled, but no, they can't. There will be places where we will stand, or as we heard described, lie belly down against an earth that feels like mom, and know we're held in comfort. And in other places, we will feel awkward, uncomfortable, worried, anxious. I think in those two places, we need different nourishment. One place, my stomach is churning and I'm not really able to eat much. And if I ate anything, it might not go down well. In the other place, I eat carelessly. You say to me, want this, and it looks great, so I pop it in my mouth. I'm not overthinking it. So that leads to me to my second source of inspiration for today, and I really think this book is just worth pondering deeply. This is, and maybe you've heard of this one, Enchantment, Awakening Wonder in an Anxious Age by Catherine May. She's a beautiful, beautiful writer, for one thing. But in this section of the book that I want to read a part of to you, and then we're going to go to another source, and I hope it'll somehow all tie together. She writes as follows. This one is called Earth. We have to fight for our ability to pay attention. It's not given. It does not assert itself as a need until it's far too late. I'm only just beginning to understand that my burnout was the result of multiple losses, each one of which seemed so small that I thought it didn't matter. I willingly surrendered my meditation time because I thought it would be vanity to demand it. I gave up reading and time alone and long hot baths and walking. I gave up silence and standing in the garden at sunrise. I let those moments become overrun by work and care, and I was surprised to find that without them, there was nothing left of me. As a child, I'd look out of the window on a nighttime drive and think the moon was following us. From my vantage point, she seemed to be chasing us along the sky, breathlessly trying to keep up. Later I learned it was just because she was so big that it felt like she was everywhere, and that I was small with an outsized sense of my own importance. Still, I was left with the impression that the moon had a certain constancy. It seemed that she was attentive to my needs, concernedly checking in. And sometimes I felt like I needed her gaze. She goes on to talk further about the moon and about a lot of distress that comes her way and the ways she's finding that she's not coping very well. She says, lately, I've returned to my silent conversations with the moon. I go outside each night when everyone's sleeping, and I try to transmit the depth of my longing for my own self back again. For time not to work, but to simply exist. For the time to feel curiosity again, without the sense that it'd only make everything harder. These feel like small, even stupid things to ask for when there's so much suffering in the world. But behind them is the wider mesh in which I'm embedded. My mother is in another country and in frail health. My husband is defending something bigger than just his working hours, some unhappiness that seems to spiral beyond his control. My son recently told me that he can't remember life before pandemics and lockdowns. They now form his baseline of how life operates. And so really, beneath it all, what I tell the moon is this. I wish I knew how to keep my people safe. I wish I knew what to do. Her next sentence will make you want to read the paragraph, but I won't. She says, the moon is an excellent confidant, but there's only so much she can do. That's the paragraph. That's the chapter called The Earth. There's lots more, and I'm going to share a little bit more from a chunk called Water later. For me this year, the question of nourishing spirit has probably been both harder and more necessary than I can remember in my lifetime. The set of losses that have come are my peers. 10 years younger, 1 year older, friends of 50 years and more, family. It doesn't seem that I've got this season right. That same anxiety I find myself feeling about the fig reminds me of me. Am I dormant in a pot in the garage, just waiting for the right temperature to come? Is there promise that I'll leaf back out again with these big, wonderful, fat clown hands that I so love on this tree? Although I'd love to see figs too. I can hear, literally, this day last year, a friend I would lose by the end of July saying to me, with a question mark, but with a certainty that just was chilling, I'm not going to live to be 80. And I remember thinking, that's ridiculous. Of course you are. He didn't live to August. And the grandkids came, and the children came, and we ran up and down the highway with casseroles, and all the best people at all the best hospitals in Boston did what they could. But it was over. Did it make sense to go to Warby Parker and buy different reading glasses when in fact you were only going to live 3 weeks? I argued yes. His son decided they were kind of cool looking and took them back to London. Many tasks, many hours, buckets of tears. But sitting here now, knowing that Easter's about to come, and last Easter he was too sick to make the roles we all love that he's so good at. And this year, I'm pretty sure there's no delivery service from heaven, though there may be time to bake. I'll try. I have the recipe. I will do the roll baking the way I'm doing the fig growing. Pretty sure I'm wrong. Asking a million questions, except the person I'd ask is heavenward. But I'm encouraged by today to think that maybe if I listen, there will be a Shekinah. I will actually hear some direction as to whether I've got the temperature in the oven correctly, or when does the egg wash go on, or how, just all in all, how does it work? And it's already okay with me if somebody says, well, they're not as good as Tim's, but it's nice to have them. Another friend whose health, a bit like our sister described that of her mother's, has been failing for a while, left us just after Thanksgiving. He was a poet and a provost and an intrepid traveler and many, many, many wonderful things along the way. Pretty good bridge player. He would put up with my bridge playing, which is perfectly awful. His only book of poetry is entitled Carrots. Literally, the orange ones. This is the title poem. In the backyard, surrounded by a ragged hedge grown neck high, my father and I turn the cool earth over. Slugs and earthworms dash for cover. Our shovels are merciless. A neighbor watching from the hedge says, there hasn't been a garden here in 20 years. We plant carrots in even rows. The sun warms us as we work. My father's shirt is off. I can see the patches of prickly white hair on his back. The seeds snuggle down easily. I rake away the clumps of grass and stones. Turn on the sprinkler. My father dozes in a canvas lawn chair. The only crop will be carrots. Long ago in this same but different earth, we grew carrots as sweet as apples. They were harvested in September, stored in a big crock in the cellar. In such silence, our carrots each year overcame Minnesota winters. Poet is David Fido, published these poems from Singapore in 2009, where two of his life-ending diagnoses began. But they began in the middle of a chapter in his life that I think felt to him like the culmination of so much of what he loved and nourished and knew exactly when to water on college and university campuses. He taught theater and literature at Mass College of Pharmacy. And I remember looking at him when he told me he'd taken that job and we were all in our 20s, scratching my head and saying one word, "Really?" I had no idea that pharmacists did theater or studied English. And David studied William Carlos Williams and was a pretty serious poet already. And I thought, I have no idea how this works, but we all needed jobs. And he had one. His next stop was at Bentley. And that was even more amazing. And there he not only taught literature, he was the dean. And I thought, Bentley must be a better place than I think it is. I just associate it with taxes and accountants and all kinds of finance people who I wouldn't know anything about. But if they love David and they want him to be their dean, there's more thinking going on there than I imagined. And then from Bentley to Curry, a little tiny school right at the edge of Milton and Canton, which looked to him like the special and wonderful place he'd been hoping for, a liberal arts school that he no sooner arrived at than a mistaken dean and an optimistic finance guy put right on the precipice of failure. They overcalculated how many students would accept admission and then planned the budget and started spending on the basis of numbers that would not materialize. Extraordinarily, a William Carlos Williams specialist, a poet, was remembered by the current president of Curry College just three weekends ago as the guy that made the difference. David knew how to put it together and keep that place of 140 years history on the map and thriving, rapidly becoming a place that even if I have serious learning differences, I can go and thrive and succeed. The team of people who spoke astonishingly did not talk about hair pulling and sharp pencils and red ink. They talked about fun. They talked about late night confabs when they put their heads together over and over and over again, trying to make it work. And that David was the person who'd ordered the pizza, said we can do this, read them a poem. I expect while he was hanging out at Bentley, he learned a lot about accounting and finance, especially as the dean, things that don't fit and cost too much and yet you need them. At Mass College of Pharmacy, he was endlessly talking about medical breakthroughs, and he, like me, both of us escapees from medical science, but lovers still, hanging on the edges, keeping track. He became a gardener, able to grow not just carrots with his elderly dad, in a patch in Minnesota, Duluth to be specific, where once they'd grown when he and his family were children, his mother gone, his dad wanting somehow to reclaim the place just for a while, and then his dad gone. David's brother, quite an actor in Chicago. David's other brother, a finance guru. The plants that grew in the Fido garden in the form of the three sons, very different. And dad's ability and mom's ability too, perhaps, I don't know her role in this garden. Not just the ability to grow carrots that were as sweet as apples that could hold off a Minnesota winter. That's a pretty special line in a poem. These aren't carrots that are worried over in the garage, like Janet worries over the fig tree in the basement. These folks are naturals. David, in his element at Curry, was a natural, If you have a chance to visit the college these days, you will see that not only are they better and well established, that era when the wolf was at the door passed, the hibernation was over, the dormancy solved, and the college moved on. In Catherine May's language, they found the moon again. They got outside. They remembered that it was important, that they were important, and that it was important for not only the shape of the sky and its illumination, but for the persistence for their students and the sustenance of everything that takes both money and patience and poems to nourish something that's shuddering and shaking, that's broken down by the wiles of time and by the ways we give up the things we need to be nourished. So I told you I'd take you back to water, and so I will. In this chapter, she tells you quite a bit about her love of swimming, and that, in fact, as an ocean swimmer, she wasn't afraid of winds or currents and did it confidently. But as time went on and aging came, she was less agile at it, less confident, and in fact had several incidents in the water that were really quite difficult. She writes about one of them early in the chapter, where she makes it to shore, but she really had to struggle. And I wasn't going to share this, but I think there's time to do it. I'm going to do that. My cat has just joined me, so I hope he'll be good. She says, in rough seas, the trick is to stay close to shore, where the action of the currents are at least predictable. I learned this last summer when I swam too far out on a snappy day and found myself drifting uncontrollably along the coast. I had to fight to get back in. And when I finally did, I took an embarrassing walk back in a wet swimsuit to my abandoned bag and towel for what felt like miles. Along the way, a man approached me. "I saw you out there," he said. "Looks like you were struggling." This is Otis. "I was fine," I replied somewhat tartly. "I swim here all the time." But I was not fine. I was rattled and cold, and my legs ached from kicking myself back to safety. Mostly, I was angry at him for noticing. I wanted to scold him for thinking he saw a swimmer in trouble and not calling the lifeboat. But equally, I was distinctly relieved that he hadn't. If I took something from that day, it was not to avoid swimming in high winds. It was to avoid making a fool of myself in front of the kind of men who sit on the beach drinking beer and commenting. She goes on then to tell a story of another moment when she similarly decided to be brave and swim in conditions that were difficult and nearly had a terrible outcome, but climbs out on wood in a pier and is all scraped up and really begins to feel deeply rattled about whether or not she can trust herself as a swimmer. And it's this piece that I find so compelling about what she writes. She goes on to actually decide to take swimming lessons, having been a lifelong swimmer. The swimming teacher is pretty unimpressed by the fact that she's a little out of shape and not as strong as she thinks she is. Swimming teacher does a little inquiring about what kind of swimming she likes to do best, and she says breaststroke. The teacher says, "Well, what about crawl?" And she said, "Nah, I really get worn out really quickly." "Well, can you do backstroke?" "Yep." But ultimately, this is now a swimming pool, not the ocean that she loves. And she's quite shocked by how hard it is to swim and by the idea
that she really needs to learn again. And she says here that at the point that she's been challenged to swim a length of the pool and does it, she says, 20 minutes later, when my lesson ends, I exit jelly-legged. I feel as though I have barely swum at all. I've paddled up and down the pool, clutching a float and kicking my legs, which is harder than it looks. I've attempted to glide along the surface of the water with something called a swim buoy, an anvil-shaped float clamped between my thighs. I've tried to obey entreaties to lift my elbows higher, no higher, no higher, and to straighten my wrists as my fingertips meet the surface of the water. And I'm fairly certain I've failed. But Wendy has stopped mentioning it for now out of kindness. And I've made an attempt to put the whole thing together, the torso, the legs, the elbows, the wrists. And in the process, have discovered that I am now substantially less than the sum of my parts. I take 10 strokes and realize I've quite forgotten to breathe. I am in inexplicable pain somewhere between my armpits. I'm entirely deconstructed. She keeps talking and then she says, I've been thrown off balance. It takes humility to get through a process like this. And that's what I'm trying to gather about me right now. If I want to swim better, I need to know nothing, be nothing for a while. I need to put myself into somebody else's hands and allow them to reform me. I need to let go of the part of me that knows better, the part of me that thinks I'm doing it right, the part of me that wants everyone else to believe I'm perfect. I'm not learning so much as unlearning. This process of finding ourselves older in life, with many more stories to tell one another of encounters that mattered, things we've tried to grow, starting on something new when we're not children, but also places where things we took for granted that we could do, we may have to learn again from the very beginning. My son's friends now live around the corner with their two children, little girls, Caroline and Sophie. We have a bit of a yard out back. And when they come over, they frequently do what we would all call gymnastics. They turn cartwheels. They run somersaults. They even, if you're Caroline, can actually almost do a backflip, which for an 8-year-old is pretty neat. I was a gymnast at their age. I continued to compete until I was about 14. I realized as I watched them that I don't really have the courage right now to throw myself at the ground imagining that I could make a perfect spiral. I spend too much time in the orthopedic lab seeing people my age with various broken bones and joints to think that would be a good idea. But I was shocked to realize that my first feeling watching them do that was not, oh, I can do that, but was instead, you'd better not do that. They didn't come over expecting that any of the grown-ups, their parents or the grandparent age people, would be joining them. They were absolutely showing us things that we could applaud and be excited about. And we were. But a bit like losing my friends, which is surely too early, this can't be the job for now. to preside at the funerals of people who I've played bridge with, cooked meals with, debated the best way to bake something with, spent endless hours on Nantucket biking with. But I guess it is. And when I ask myself, how do you know how to do that, Janet? Well, it's years of putting that pot in the basement, knowing whether to water it or not, pulling it up when it's time. Those are things I actually don't want to do, but I know how to do. And I've learned them standing near the others who were sorrowing, whose turn it was before me. I learned it with my parents, finding my brother's insistence on certain dogmatic aspects of their funerals, but his complete incapacity to choose a hymn because they all made him cry. He's 8 years my senior, and I think the only times I've seen him cry before that were laughing hysterically, trying to read us Winnie the Pooh. He was a big boy. He took care of us younger kids. But trying to choose the hymns for Dad's service was just too much. It was my turn to take care of him. These turns we take in life where somebody tells us, oh, don't worry about watering that, it'll be fine. And is it natural in that moment? The moments when we swam confidently in the ocean for years until we don't, and find out that somebody was even watching us falter and didn't help but only commented. Is the same moment we discover we do have enough wisdom to go back outside and listen to the moon. To take an elderly dad who won't even live long enough to see those carrots grow and plant them anyway. To listen or watch for moments of holiness that emerge in places we didn't plant them, but at just the moments we need them. And God bless us, even to head off to the Y and get swimming lessons. Figure out how to make that hip, knee, shoulder, jaw work again. It's such a strange thing to discover that this gardening we do is from within as well as without. And at times it's as though we've never gardened before at all, and we truly need somebody at our elbow to tell us what to do and when to do it, and we won't trust it anyway. And on the other hand, we turn the soil, put in the bulbs, 450 tulips in my case, out in the front garden. And somebody said, did you plant each one? And I thought, well, sort of. I mean by that, I dug a great big trench and slammed as many of them in there as I could possibly get because I, one, want them to look like that, but two, my achy back won't put up with a whole lot more than that. But I want them. I hope that they can be, and my friend who runs the Wicked Tulip operation down in South Kingstown is just too sweet and has too many beautiful colors for me to not go down there and come home with 300 more. That impulse to keep moving, to keep learning, to keep repairing and reorienting ourselves, in my mind, is the nourishing of the spirit. But I don't think it's ever quite done, and I think there's much of it that as we try to do it, we end up having to redo it. We find out that that breaststroke we thought we were swimming our whole lives is really not very efficient. And somebody much younger, who doesn't take us too seriously, but takes us seriously enough to give us a workout
and hopes that we will go back to the beach with confidence and love, and sees that that's why we've turned up in the winter for swimming lessons. So I leave you with my fig tree and these clown hands. I do wish you a fig. There are varieties you can leave outside, I'm told, now that I've started doing this one that you have to go inside and outside. So maybe I'll change my mind. But I think the question of can we have it all is probably yes and no. And that idea of an 11-year-old whose fingers on your cheek in the middle of the night to tell you that the hamster's back is such a sweet image. It has never happened to me, and I can feel it still. There is a voice, she says. You can still summon it will, like your mother's. It will always whisper. You can't have it all, but there is this. It might be just enough to nourish us for the journey and be different for each one of us, and yet have many, many, many growing, changing pieces that will be about both devastation and abundance. Glad to open this up for any conversation we want to have together. So many things I always think of after these sessions are over that I want to talk with everybody about. So, but I really do recommend these books. If you're interested, I'll send along the citations. This is
great. Thank you. Yeah, we're developing a resource list. That would be really great, Janet. And we do have some time still in Janet's part of the day, where people want to ask Janet questions or reflect to her what they're thinking about as she was sharing her talk. Please consider that, Mary Margaret.
Thank you so much, Janet. I feel it was very I haven't forgotten the word, I just can't get it out. Very moving and touching, and so much of it that I could identify with. And I'm sure others.
Thank you.
This
is such a loving, broad group to be with. And I barely know any of you. And I still have that. It's such a strong feeling that comes out of the things people say and offer. So thank you for that sense of safety and welcome that from the very first minute I got to join you, I have felt, and I look forward to every time this is something I get to do. So it's quite miraculous gathering, and especially electronically.
Yeah.
How can this be possible? But it is.
I know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Paula?
I want to thank you also very, very much for coming back and speaking about the gardens. And you reminded me of when you spoke about people who are gone, and you spoke about your fig tree. My husband had an incredible fig tree, and he grew them. And it was like there were some for the archives, which is like the basement. And there was one that he planted outside and babied through like 4 warm winters. And they were magnificent figs. So I just want to say, you just reminded me, and I so appreciate the reminder, because also I don't have a green thumb. So I appreciate all the comparisons. And what was the first book you read from with the puppies on the cover?
This is Bite Every Sorrow. You see it?
Bite Every Sorrow by?
Barbara Ross.
Okay.
It's a collection of poems, and she's a very broad poet. The range of her topics is quite, I mean, some of these almost funny, and others of them much darker and deep. Wonderful.
Interesting. And then the last thing I wanted to say was that for some reason today, I feel really the closeness that we get from Zoom. you know, at first we all complained about the tech of Zoom, but I feel a closeness that's amazing. And I thank you very much also.
Oh my gosh. I feel it too. And it's just, when first we had to do gatherings like this, I kind of dreaded them. I thought, how is this going to work? But it does. And it's for me better than just talking by phone, but I'll take that too.
I wanted to just say that at each time you said, can we have it all? And then, but there is this, the phrase that went through me was, and can we keep it all? I think that's another phrase, but it still also works with, but there is this. It's like if we can't keep it all, because we can't. I mean, I have treasured things and treasured things that have memories in them, and treasured pieces, even pieces of art, and I can't keep it all. And it's not like losing a person. Certainly, but there is a loss. I'm in a period of my life where I'm choosing to let go of things that I love, not things that are extra or things that I have more of or things that I don't need, but things that I love. And that can we have it all and can we keep it all? Feel like they're kind of cousin phrases right now for me. So I thank you for bringing us, to that poem and just sitting with that, to just sitting with it. Yeah.
There's a whole other chunk of this, some of what I've been working with you today about, that I hope to add into a piece that I'm doing for First Baptist Church in America in the late part of April. But that last chunk comes from this book. And I was trying to figure out a way to fit it into our time, and I just think it's too much. Tia Miles teaches at Harvard. This book is entitled All That She Carried. And it's actually creative nonfiction based on a fabric bag. I'll read the back to you so you'll see what she's doing with this. But it's so related to your point about having and keeping.
Yeah.
Right. So here's what's on the back of the book. It says, in the 1850s, South Carolina, an enslaved woman named Rose faced a crisis. The imminent sale of her daughter, Ashley. Thinking quickly, she packed a cotton bag for her with a few items, and soon after, the 9-year-old girl was separated from her mother and sold. Ashley's granddaughter, Ruth, embroidered this family history on the sack in spare, haunting language.
Wow.
Historian Tia Miles carefully traces these women's faint presence in archival records, and where the archives fall short, she turns to objects, art, and the environment to write a singular history of the experience of slavery and the uncertain freedom afterward in the United States. All That She Carried is a poignant story of resilience and love passed down against steep odds. It honors the creativity and resourcefulness of people who preserved family ties when official systems refused to do so. So I just want to read you one line out of the very end of this book. Ruth Middleton is she's the person who did the embroidery on the sack that was passed forward. She writes, Ruth Middleton stood toward the end of a long line of women survivors. She was clearly conscious, even reverent, of this lineage and her special place in it. And she used fabric, as women had for centuries, in a process not only of memorializing their families, but also of creating these families. Perhaps this sensibility of family making by passing down objects inspired Ruth's use of varied earth tones in her embroidery. The brown thread of the opening lines give way to green thread by the close, mimicking the loose form of an inverted family tree with roots reaching back into the past and shoots fanning out into the future, where the written record of known time ends. Ruth, a daughter, mother, embroiderer, storyteller, and historian of her family's past, died of tuberculosis while in her mature youth, but not yet 40. She had been ill for months and under the care of her friend Martha Horsey, who also provided data for the death certificate. Ruth succumbed to the disease at Frederick Douglass Memorial Hospital in the winter of 1942, just under a century since her grandmother Ashley had been taken from her great-grandmother Rose in an undocumented slave sale. Ruth's own daughter Dorothy, who would have inherited the sack, passed on in 1988 with no known lineal descendants. Afterward, the textile was lost, perhaps boxed, donated, or sold with other items once attached to these lives as ephemeral as their own. But the bag Rose packed, the cloth Ashley kept, and the tale Ruth told live on to declare the staying power of love's ties and women's stories. The bag made it to a museum. And Tia puts the story back together. I'm sure this is partly because I too am trying to figure out what you can see behind me. This is but a piece of the books in this house. You can't give them to Brown, right? And my office at work is worse. And Amazon keeps delivering books. So it's trying to figure out what to keep, what to let go.
Yes.
What to label. Mm-hmm. I think is really an incredibly important piece. And I love the fact that she puts this story back together from, in fact, the very careful archival work. I mean, there's a part of this story that's so interesting. In that bag, according to the record, were three handfuls of pecans. So how would that have happened? Right. And she figures out that the guy who probably owned these women, the little girl and her mother, right, was very newly wealthy. Pecans only showed up in this part of the world during holiday times, and he died just after our Christmas. So she's thinking that the mom, Ashley's mother, just kept kind of sneaking a few pecans out of the cooking that she did, right? And had them to give to her daughter. And one of the things that Tia makes a point of is she said, as sad as this story is, she feels we're really wrongheaded to see it that way. She said, this is a story of love. This is a story of what can, and I don't know if that'll help you, but it's helping me. I find myself thinking, what do I love? That's the stuff I'm going to keep, even if nobody else wants it. They'll know one thing about me, which is that I like that stuff. You know, if they throw it away, that's fine. I won't be there to feel bad about it. Mm-hmm. But it helps me, instead of thinking what's valuable or what, you know, most of the value of these things is to me, not to anybody else. And some of these books I barely remember, candidly. I either never read them or I bought them in grad school or something happened along the way that I thought they were important. And I took two ideas and off on the shelf they went. So.
Yeah, and your offering of this book is timely because we're looking for our own ideas next year of things we might do together as a group, read a book together and discuss it. Or so this sounds like one of the possibilities. So thank you.
She was interviewed on NPR recently and tells this story of how she – this is really a story of creative nonfiction, mm-hmm. you know, where when you only have parts of the story
– yeah.
Boy, that, I don't know if that's not true for everybody, but it's sure true for me. I have bits and pieces of our family story. And then you kind of fill in the spaces, but I think I'm not right. And she's such a encouraging, sister saying, yeah, go ahead, you know, fill it in, but do your research because you might be able to, as she figures out with the pecans, right? You might be able to kind of piece together how does this lead back to probably where they were. And I haven't done justice to the story, but the book, she also writes beautifully.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
And
She's
we're
also
also.
just down the street in Cambridge. You could summon her for an in-person.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank
Yeah,
you.
yeah.
So we're at our 1 o'clock time. So